And I'm very happy to announce our next speaker, who will be giving the first one of the day. Yes, dear friend and colleague Ben Wagner, actually I have your bio here in German, we could do this in a fun Dinglish way, is one of Germany's experts when it comes to digital human rights and also runs a center of internet and human rights here in Berlin, which is part of the Quadriner University in Frankfurt Oder. And we're very happy to welcome Ben here today to speak to us about European net politics and why a centralized European approach does not make sense. A big applause for Dr. Ben Wagner, please.
Thank you for coming and thank you for staying here. I realized that when somebody said there's a Überwachungsgesamtrechnung in the next room and it's like about all of this surveillance stuff, half of the room just stood up and left. And that might also be because this is in English or that it's complicated or it's about sort of policy stuff and words and things that people don't really like because it's not about fixing, hacking technologies quickly to find fast solutions. But it's also about what was already discussed, which is finding long-term social solutions that actually improve the way technology works and ensuring that through those solutions, we can find a way to really ensure that human rights, but also the values we aspire to have in the internet, actually exist in the internet and work in the internet. And I think that's quite important for many different reasons. And I'd like to encourage you, when you have a look at this picture, when I have conversations with most of the activists around the world, it seems, for some reason or another, that this little red dot is the part of the center of the entire policymaking world. And as you can probably see, this little red dot is in Berlin. Sometimes they'll also say Brussels, but like the basic fact is that most of the activists in these communities that we're part of and that I'm part of as well tend to focus on lobbying the Bundesregierung, the German government, many different government agencies, or the EU, and that's where we see most of the different internet political debates happening. That's to say that if we want to change something, we go to the German government, we maybe go to another government in Europe, but it's hard to imagine a government outside of Germany or outside of Europe that might be important in trying to decide what the future of the internet is. And yes, of course, there's the US and there's other large governments. But what I'd like to argue here is that by the time we actually have conversations about those governments and those policies, it's already far too late. Because you need to look far longer and in far greater depth at how policies develop to understand how they come to become what they become. And also far outside of Europe in order to understand how a global internet becomes a global internet. And so I'm going to look here, just a few ideas. The first one is cutting off the internet. Has anybody heard recently about cutting off the internet in India? Is that something people know about? Yes, there's hands up, thank you. So people have heard about the internet being cut off in India and many other parts of the world, which we'll go into in a second. Net neutrality, obviously, is a debate that is ongoing in many parts of Europe right now and quite intensely. And of course, surveillance reform. Those, I would say, are reasonably relevant points on an activist's agenda working on different forms of human rights advocacy, right? And so when you look at those points, just to start off with cutting off the internet, I was in London in 2011. And these are photos from the riots in London. This guy is, I think, I'm not quite sure what he's exactly throwing, but he's throwing something. And how you interpret that entirely depends on your political disposition. But just to say that it was quite an intense time, and it was interesting living in a block of flats in London where blocks of flats around London were being lit up and burnt. And you're realizing, when these riots happen, things get a little bit dangerous sometimes. And of course, nothing really, no human being, as far as I'm aware, was seriously injured during these riots. But what's important is that during these riots, the British government came out and said, okay, we're concerned about these rioters, we're not sure what to do about it, let's turn off the internet. And there were various different debates about this. It didn't happen in the end. Part of the reason that it didn't happen is because they said, well, we'll look like China if we do it, which is always a good reason not to do something. But clearly, there was a debate, and a very important debate in a European country about building this idea of a red button, that you press the red button and you turn off the internet. And so when you're looking at this, you'd think, okay, well, not really a big deal. Except that then it also happened in Egypt. And again, we have somebody who turns off the internet. Everybody going, oh my God, what are we going to do? What are these people going to do without smartphones? Help. And so you have an ongoing debate, same question, what happens if people turn off the internet? And the uncomfortable fact out of this is we know about London, the debates, we know about Egypt where it happens. What nobody looks at is Pakistan. So this is a map of the internet disconnections in Pakistan in the last 3 years. We've been doing some research in Pakistan with Bytes for All and different other NGOs and also university there, ITU University, where what we're realizing is it's happened 24 times in Pakistan in the last 3 years since the beginning of 2012, and nobody cares. Nobody, it's just like a complete, we get worked up about it when we realize it, when it's in the news, when it's interesting, when it's sexy, but when it comes regular, it's just a statistic, and who cares about Pakistan anyway? So you're in a situation where if you don't document the information, if you don't write down the fact that the internet is getting cut off around the world all the time, you A, don't understand it, and B, the next time when somebody in London or Madrid or any other European capital decides we need a red button to turn off the internet, we also don't have any data to say this is a good idea, this is a bad idea, this might have these consequences, because we've never actually looked at the cases where these things happen until it's far too late. And part of the problem with that is, of course, it's extremely difficult to conduct research on things where you don't know where they're going to happen suddenly, but then it's also important to start looking for these cases to understand why they're happening and to understand the social, economic, political consequences, but to also understand how people deal with it, because if this is so frequent, you can be damn sure that people in Pakistan have a pretty good and quite well-adapted solution that doesn't have to mean, let's build a technical solution like an internet in a suitcase. That might not be the most obvious solution, rather than to say, let's build a mesh network and solve all of their problems technically. Let's ask the human beings first who are being disconnected how they're solving their problems, and then work based on that to understand maybe those problems, once a European or other African, South American, Asian government has a similar idea, how they're trying to fix these problems, because they might actually have better solutions than we would immediately come up with. Another example, if we look at net neutrality, is that the most interesting countries in the world for net neutrality are completely, well, not entirely outside of Europe, but certainly outside of most of the public debate. So, as is probably well known here, Chile is one of the first countries that has one of the most rigorous net neutrality laws, Techno-Lama, and on the other side we have a Slovenian professor who was also, funnily enough, a former government minister. And the sad thing is that neither of these individuals have particularly good data about the effects of net neutrality laws in Slovenia or in Chile. That's to say that the people, either NGOs or people who have really like been part of government and also have been part of sort of a, now a university who's responsible for doing research on all of these issues, we don't know that much about what net neutrality actually does in practice. There's a bit of research here, there's a bit of understanding there, but for example, in Chile, it's almost impossible to understand what are the consequences of having a net neutrality law and what issues, what difficulties, how does the market change? We all know that there are certain normative reasons we would want it. What we don't have is good data to justify that. And I think sooner or later that's going to become a serious concern, because when you go to policymakers, when you go to different people who are trying to be convinced by your arguments, it really helps to have data on the cases where you already have net neutrality laws. And if you don't have that data, if you don't have those abilities to empirically justify your argument automatically becomes less convincing. And then last of all, oh no, excuse me, one more thing. Does anybody on net neutrality, does anybody know where this country is? Where's the white dot? Any guesses? But close, not quite, but getting warmer. Any idea where the white dot might be? Yes, thank you. Somebody saw Zambia there. So Zambia, again, incredibly important because this is where internet.org started. And yet, despite the fact that this is where internet.org, which is the sort of crappy, shitty, pretend version of the internet built by Facebook to claim that they're now connecting the world, has nothing to do with net neutrality for obvious reasons, but does give some kind of connectivity to people who previously didn't have any kind of internet connectivity at all. And then you have to ask yourself the question, why is there no local research happening in Zambia about the effects of that? Because when you speak to people on the ground there, we don't have any information about it. And yes, that's partially because Facebook and also the telecommunication companies in Chile that we were talking about beforehand are very unwilling to share that data because it's not in their commercial interest. But at the same time, if we don't understand the effects of the beginning of what seems like the future of the internet, whether we like it or not, internet.org is developing into that in many parts of the world. If we don't have data about that, if we don't have information to understand those questions, how are we going to respond in situations like right now in India, where internet.org is being rolled out, and you then, of course, have all sorts of reasons based on, yes, it's stupid that you don't allow SSL on internet.org, or it's ridiculous that only 10 websites are available, and still, you don't have good data that allows you to say, and this also has these consequences on access to medical information, access to open educational resources, and many other issues that are related to that. So what I'm trying to say is we need to know more about these very important cases in many parts of the world, and we need to start looking at them in greater detail. Otherwise, we won't be able in 3 or 5 years' time, when the question about internet.org also becomes part of a political debate about net neutrality, as is the case right now in Europe, we won't have good arguments because we won't be able to justify it based on actual data. And the final example. surveillance and surveillance reform. So again, we usually talk about the NSA and American spying around the world and various different aspects of it. And I'm not going to say that this is not an important debate. By no means would I want to be suggested as that. It's just that it's a very common aspect of the debate. And what's missed in a lot of this is that the timing of surveillance and surveillance reform seems to always happen at the same time. That's to say that when countries are in some kind of constitutional crisis, when there's a moment where the government is actually willing to reform things, places like Bosnia suddenly realize that their deputy director and director of the security services are more powerful than the prime minister. That's a problem, and then based on that, reform takes place. What it doesn't mean is that because we have one global event, like, for example, the Snowden revelations, that the whole world is now going to reform their surveillance apparatuses and their intelligence services, because realistically, that's probably not going to happen. I have another example, which is from Poland. I'm currently a visiting professor in Poznan, and so I get to use all of the Polish examples and pretend like they're mine. This is the Mackiewicz list that I can't even properly pronounce from 1992. After the end of the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the large parts of the Soviet Union, a list was published by Polish authorities, which basically had a list of all former KGB individuals who were still part of the Polish intelligence services in some way. In a way, it's like a list that the Germans should have had right after the end of the Nazis, and listing all of the German BND or German Verfassungsschutz employees who were also part of the Nazis. And so in some way or another, publishing that list allows for a change in the way the security services worked and led to a massive reform of the security apparatus. And yet still, you're in a situation where, despite this reform process, despite all of these things that had happened, this was only a partial and not complete reform of the security services. That's to say, an event like Snowden on its own doesn't necessarily change every single surveillance regime in the world, but you need to look at each individual country, each individual case, and there are individual places in the world, like, for example, the Ukraine right now, where there is sufficient turmoil, where there is likely to be reform. And it's more looking at the places where there's relevant reform possibility and where intelligence services are likely to have to change their practices, rather than to say in every country in the world, automatically, change is likely to happen. So to simplify that, to start with the net neutrality arguments and also the arguments about disconnection, if you can't count it, it really doesn't exist at a policy level. And as frustrating as that may be as a postmodern critical scholar, whatever, it's a fact. And the fact is that we're not particularly good at documenting a lot of the arguments that we're making in regard to intelligence human rights. And unless we get better at documenting those arguments, counting those arguments, making numbers out of those arguments, we're quickly going to be in a situation where we don't have good empirical data to justify why rights are important. And of course, they're also important because human beings deserve rights. There's no argument that then says there shouldn't also be a more fundamental normative argument saying these are the values we stand for, therefore they are, but it helps to have good data. And let's not pretend that there's not some kind of a debate with other human beings where it would at least be helpful to suggest numbers that suggest negative social impacts and negative human rights effects wouldn't somehow be helpful. And that's basically, in the same point, advocacy needs empirical data. But at the same time also, and it's the last point, timing matters. Because if you see the whole world as just a large hodgepodge of different negative surveillance repressive regimes which need to be reformed and changed, you're less likely to be able to change them if you understand them as individual countries in individual contexts where the individual logics of things that have nothing to do with surveillance matter far much more than the individual cases of specific surveillance reform as a whole. Or to put it another way, if we don't think a little bit more about power centers outside of Brussels and outside of Berlin, we might be able in 5 years or in 10 years' time when this, or this, or this for that matter, is the center of the internet policy-making world, we might know a little bit more about it and be in a little bit better position to actually respond with effective positions, with ideas and suggestions based on real data and real people situations. Thank you very much. Questions?
Yeah, but no, even though you were so on time, is there one pressing question? A very clever question only, though, for this very clever talk that was just given. No pressure at all.
Also, stupid questions are always welcome, too. So
no, those stupid questions are only welcome off stage.
Okay,
fair today, enough. Because we're so short in time.
Gotcha.
But you're going to be with us for the rest of the day, correct?
Yes.
That is wonderful to hear for many reasons, but also because you'll be able to answer all the clever and not so clever questions throughout the remainder of the day.
All questions are welcome, really.
But because of our tight schedule, for now, we're just going to give you another big warm applause.
Thank you
and
so
welcome our next speaker.